Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Sophia Wilson and this week I'm joined by Charlotte Hogarth-Jones. Hi Charlotte, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. It's been a busy week and obviously a bit of a weird week in London, as I'm sure everyone can appreciate from elsewhere around the world.
Yeah, so we felt we should sort of acknowledge at the top of the podcast, on behalf of Boat International Media, obviously our incredible sadness at the news of the death of Her Majesty the Queen. Our thoughts are very much with all the royal family during this period of national mourning.
Well, yeah, particularly because, you know, the Queen's passing is something that affects so many people. But, you know, she loved her boats. I can't think, over the past week or so, I've seen all this amazing old photography. And a lot of it is of her coming on and off yachts in different areas of the world. She definitely had, an incredible relationship with the sea, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, she obviously spent a lot of time on board her beloved Royal Yacht Britannia, where she was also reportedly one of the best at dealing with seasickness, potentially, apparently, even better than her husband, which, given he was an admiral in the Navy, is quite something. And she, of course, famously shed a public tear when the yacht was decommissioned in 1997. And after that, she actually went to spend quite a bit of time on board a yacht called Leanne de G., which was generously loaned to her by her then owner, Sir Donald Gosling. I actually wrote a big kind of iconic yacht report looking at this yacht's history. It must have been back in kind of 2020. And it was really fascinating as part of that. I went back and spoke to the captain that was on board and hosted the Queen and things like that. And it was really fascinating to get some insights into her time on board. Unfortunately, quite a lot of it was off record. But
yeah, I was going to say, what did she have for breakfast? What did he report? I can't imagine he said very much.
No, I think, I mean, he didn't say that much. And I think he, you know, reiterated that she just loved being at sea and she loved that feeling of having some space and some privacy. And I think in particular, that's what Royal Yacht Britannia gave her as well. I actually had a look around Royal Yacht Britannia when I was in Edinburgh on a different press trip a few years ago. And it was fascinating. It was so much more homely, I think, than I'd imagined, which apparently is very similar to kind of Buckingham Palace's home quarters. It's not, you know, you kind of imagine it would be grand and gold and chandeliers, and it really wasn't like that at all. Have you ever been on board?
I haven't. I've been to Windsor Castle. I went earlier this year because they were doing a sort of gathering of the Dunkirk little ships, all the boats that had gone out to help then, as a kind of anniversary commemorative thing. But I do, you know, I know what you mean. Looking around there, the decor is very kind of, you know, grand and beautiful, but also quite kind of cozy and slightly down at heel in the kind of very British, old-fashioned, comfy type way. So I can imagine the boat being somewhat similar.
Yeah, well, I mean, Royal Yacht Britannia, I know it's intended for her to be there for years to come until, I mean, I think she'll always be remembered as being, you know, a big part of the Queen's reign. So I'm sure she'll have many more thousands of visitors in the years to come. I know she's shut until after the period of royal mourning finishes. And in the meantime, we'll have to see whether any of these rumours about a new royal yacht under King Charles III come to fruition. I somehow doubt that they will, but there's been a few designs released recently, so it gives us something to talk about at least.
Well, given his kind of eco credentials, hopefully if it does go ahead, it will be something quite unusual and quite trailblazing in that respect, one would hope anyway.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, just to reiterate that Boat International's thoughts are very much with the royal family. Moving on, however, I need to apologise that there was no Boat Briefing last week. Charlotte and I were all set to record and I was in the office on Monday morning working on the script when we suddenly realised that, unfortunately, due to a colleague catching COVID, that there was going to be a spare room going in Cannes. And as a result, by about 11 a.m, I left the office and was on my way to Gatwick in true kind of boat style. So it was unfortunate in terms of the podcast, but it worked really well for me because it meant I got to have a couple of unexpected days at the Cannes Yachting Festival.
I heard it was kind of scorchingly hot out there. Toby, our CEO, was bemoaning how humid it was and he can cope in much better temperatures than I am. So did you find it a nightmare?
It was very hot. And as you say, Toby and I are both quite famed in the office for liking a bit of sunshine. And it was very hot. It was that kind of hot where everyone you talk to says, "It's hot, isn't it?" And you reply and say, "Yes, it's very hot. Are you hot?" "Yes, I'm hot." No, it was, I think it was the humidity that, because it wasn't, I mean, it was 32 degrees. So, I mean, that's not, and it's warm, but it's not outrageous. But I think it was that coupled with the humidity did just make it feel quite oppressive. But heat aside, it was incredibly busy and it is a fantastic show. It is huge as well, Cannes. I hadn't really appreciated the kind of size of it. And there were a few real highlights for me. One of them in particular was I got to go on board Mabel, which is the brand new Sherpa 80XL, which was launched by Arcadia Yachts literally just a few weeks ago. And it's owned by Paola Trofiro, who is, of course, one of our long-standing World Superyacht Award judges. It's a really cool kind of futuristic design, and Paola's was very involved with the interior, and it's kind of real beach house style. You can really see her kind of touches across the yacht, which is really nice. And it's also got some really great exterior spaces, particularly for a yacht of that size. So on the aft deck, there's this unique sort of winter garden, which is set up with glass sliding doors. So you can completely close off the space so it can be either heated or cool, depending on the temperature. Or you can have it completely open so it just looks, you know, like a kind of normal aft deck dining area. Mm. Obviously, as discussed, it was so hot in Cannes that it was all kind of open. But what was amazing was when it was all open, you really had to kind of look to realise where the glass would come in and enclose it. And I thought that was a really cool way of kind of really maximising the space on a yacht, because you can literally have it either as an interior or exterior space.
That sounds really interesting.
And then another one of, I had a really interesting meeting with Alex Bamberg, who is the CEO of Aqua Superpower. I think I've become a bit obsessed about this to the point where I've really like bored my team with it. But he, so Aqua Superpower is building a fully electric infrastructure of kind of charging networks aimed at the global marine market. So Alex actually came from the automotive industry, and he was very involved in setting up the kind of charging points around the UK for the car network, particularly with new electric models coming in, and they were struggling to sell these electric models because there just wasn't the appetite for them. And they kind of realised that people weren't going to start to buy these electric cars unless there was the infrastructure in place to make it easy for them. So the previous company that Alex worked for set, you know, was very involved in creating this infrastructure, and obviously now electric car sales are going through the roof. He had some really fascinating statistics about, you know, I think virtually across Europe, more electric cars are selling than traditional cars. And, you know, there's been a huge kind of momentum swing that way. So he's now obviously trying to take this knowledge from the automotive industry and move it into the marine sector. And obviously these kind of charging points are never going to be viable for super yachts. But walking down the quay that was at Cannes, it's really impressive to see how many electric tenders are now on the market. And I can only see this sector continuing to grow. And of course, Water Toys as well, you know, this are going to utilise all this kind of technology. So his idea is that there will eventually be a network so that if you are an electric boat owner, you don't have to worry that much about, oh, where's the next charging point? Because, you know, particularly in that kind of area of France, for example, there will be one every couple of nautical miles. So you can enjoy your boat exactly how you'd like to. And, you know, the charging points are there as and when you need them. As you can tell, I'm fully bought in and boring everyone with this idea.
Because that's the big stumbling point at the moment, right? Owners, you know, you would very much have to tailor your itinerary and your journey around where, you know, you can top up, which is never going to kind of be a good solution. So they do need to have more of them.
Yeah, and I think there's understandable anxiety. You know, the idea of being stuck at sea without power is quite rightly scary. And I think, therefore, people probably wouldn't push it to that extent. And, you know, it's similar with electric cars. You know, we all manage to not run out of fuel on the road all the time because you know where to refuel. And I think it's just a case of changing that mindset to kind of electricity. But I can see on a boat there is heightened anxiety around that. And it is trying to make it as simple as possible for people just to be able to enjoy it. And while I'm on the electric bandwagon, there was also a bit of chat at the show about the first electric Riva prototype, which was actually revealed at the premiere the week before down at the Monaco Yacht Club, which Stuart was at. So I'm sure he might be able to share a few more details. I don't know whether he even managed to get on board. I'm sure he'll fill you in next week. So it's just a prototype at this stage, but it has a cruising speed of 25 knots. With a self-limited top speed of 40 knots. So, I mean, it's really, it's going some. And it also has up to 10 hours navigation in economy mode. She looks very much like a classic Riva. So she's just a reimagined version of the model that already exists. And the Ferretti Group CEO, Alberto Galassi, spoke really well at the press conference about the importance of how important it is to get it right with this Riva. And that they're not just kind of playing with it and they don't want it to be a gimmick. So there hasn't been any kind of formal announcement about when she's going to be released to the market, but it looks like it might be kind of towards the end of 2023 at the earliest to kind of really ensure that, yeah, as I say, she's not a gimmick, it's the real deal.
I mean, that sounds really cool. It's interesting, the electric thing, because on the one hand, I can totally see the future of it, particularly for smaller yachts like a Riva that don't necessarily need a huge range We actually ran a feature on really cool electric tenders and kind of smaller boats a while back. I'll link it in the description in case anyone's interested. And they really felt like a sort of totally different breed. They were very stylish, very cool. It's no surprise that some of them hailed from the Netherlands because a lot of them had this kind of very cool, minimal, Scandi design thing going on. And something the piece highlighted that I hadn't really thought about was the sort of minimum noise pollution. So if you're someone who cares a lot about getting up close and personal with nature, or you're kind of quieter yachty, then they're the ideal solution, because you can go into bays or protected areas where these kind of big diesel yachts simply aren't allowed to go, and there's sort of minimal disruption to the wildlife. So that sounded very appealing to me, and I could, all of these models that we'd profiled, I was thinking, yeah, I can totally see that. I bet that's going to be really successful. But on the other hand, I have heard some quite alarming rumblings about electric fires lately. There's been a lot of chat about that at the shows. And anyone who follows Boat International News on Facebook, if you don't, where have you been? Because it's like my favourite source of all gossip. But anyway, you kind of can't help to notice the huge number of yacht fires we've had lately. And there's a lot of speculation in the comments as to why this is. Some people are kind of accusing owners of trying to cash in on insurance jobs. Don't know how much truth there is to that. While other people are kind of speculating, it's the electric. Because if you think about it, whether you've got an electric engine on board or just a whole load of water toys, right? So many of these things, if you've got electric surfboards, seabob, jet skis, you know, lots of these things have lithium ion batteries. They can easily sort of compromise your boat, and they are a fire hazard. Stuart even said he'd heard someone in Cannes say that the insurers are starting to get involved and are either going to jack up the premiums of battery powered boats or even not insure them, which sounds like that'd be a really drastic move. So anyway, we plan to investigate all of this. You know, you often find these rumours stem from those with alternatives to plug. So we will do our own truth seeking here and do a feature for you very soon, outlining how much of a risk these things are, if they're not a risk, what you can do to mitigate them, and what's the best way of approaching it. But it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that piece, I think.
Yeah, I'm a bit skeptical of those rumours. I think it might just be a kind of easy bandwagon to jump on, but I don't know. And I also didn't hear, I clearly, Stuart was getting much better gossip than me in Cannes, because I didn't hear that. But what I did hear lots about at Cannes, I was clearly having a much more geeky time, is I was doing quite a bit of coverage for the boat business section of the website, which, for those of you who don't know, it's kind of the industry-focused content of our website. You have to sign up to access it, but it's free, and it also has its own weekly dedicated newsletter. So I can highly recommend it for anyone that's looking to stay up to date with the latest sort of industry news. But yeah, as I say, as part of this, I was very much kind of head down in the figures being released. And it was quite remarkable. You know, I don't know about you, Charlotte, but I kind of feel like listening to the radio at the moment, reading the papers, it's all quite doom and gloom and, you know, recession and everything else. And that just certainly didn't seem to be the case in terms of the numbers that were coming out from a yachting perspective. So, I mean, a few headlines for you. The Ferretti Group announced a 50% increase in order take in July and August in comparison to the same period last year. So the brand confirmed that it had taken an impressive €300 million worth of orders just since the 30th of June this year.
Gosh, they are absolutely killing it, aren't they, Ferretti Group? Yeah. Every time I read anything from them, I'm just staggered at the amount they're doing. That's insane.
Yeah, British builder Sunseeker also announced it has a forward order book of more than £600 million. And it's selling out basically across its range, including 12 units of its new 100 yacht have already been sold. They obviously had the first 100 was there at Cannes on debut. Nautor Swan also reported a 44% increase overall in their order book, with an approximate value of €145 million. Obviously, that's, you know, more sailing yacht sector, which is a harder sector, but they still seem to be really pleased with the results they're seeing. And just before the show, San Lorenzo also released their H1 figures, reporting net revenues of €344.9 million for the sale of new yachts, which again is a 30.8% increase on the previous year. And when you consider when we were talking about last year being kind of crazy, it seems mad that the figures are either staying stable or they're increasing. So yeah, I mean, we'll have to keep an eye on it, but the shipyards clearly seem to be doing something right in the market.
Yeah, I mean, that's insane. It just, those numbers are amazing. And it does, I'm always kind of on the concerned, like, oh God, you know, what's going to happen when it all comes crashing down? But for now, you know, for these shipyards and things that have had a difficult couple of years, they're certainly not even recovering. I don't even know how much of a dip they had, but it's interesting to see that the figures backing up what they've all been saying.
Yeah, and I was speaking to Stephen Hills, who's the chair of Superyacht UK, before I went out to Cannes, and we were kind of saying, you know, is the recession coming, and, you know, how's everyone fared? And his argument was kind of, we are in a much stronger place to be going into recession with a strong order book than if we weren't. So it's any good news like that and any strong order book is only going to help kind of proof the industry through if there are tougher economic times ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, we've seen lots of new boats being ordered recently. And one of the features I've been working on is actually to do with the sudden kind of boom in secondhand boats. You know, lots of new owners throughout the pandemic buying boats who maybe hadn't bought boats before or buying second boats. And lots of these were already on the market and needed a bit of a facelift. But as was the nature of the pandemic, people wanted them quickly. So they didn't want to then lock them up in refit sheds for the next 2 years. They wanted them very often to have a quick kind of facelift and get them out on the water so they could use them or so they could make the most of this sort of very lucrative charter market that we're seeing at the moment. So we've written this piece. It's out in our November issue, which is a refit special. So if you're thinking of doing a refit, there's loads of stuff in there that you'll find useful. And this is all about how to do a kind of record fast refit. I have to say, it didn't make me the most popular journalist on the planet, because one of the things that was abundantly clear from speaking to people was that whether it's the yards or the designers, no one really likes doing these things. You know, owners want it, they realise there's a demand here, but for them it makes for quite a stressful period, and there's permanently a worry that the quality of what they're doing is going to be compromised by trying to do things too quickly. But nonetheless, owners do want it. So I thought I'd sort of pull out from the main piece just a few of the tips that came out in case you're thinking of doing something like this yourself. So one of the first things everyone said was that make sure your yard has got the right kind of kit for the job you specifically need. And there are a lot of things that came out of it, like in-house cranes or ship lifts or an enclosed wet basin that meant work could be done without kind of lifting the yacht out of the water. Things like that. If the yard has it in-house, that's going to speed things up versus trying to kind of use equipment or use external teams from elsewhere. And something I hadn't really thought about was also kind of making sure that your yard has the facilities that if other yachts or other projects are delayed, yours isn't kind of boxed in or affected by delays to other projects. So your yacht can move as soon as it's ready to go. Another thing, which was kind of unusual thing I hadn't heard of before, but makes a lot of sense, was if you're really keen to get things done really quickly, why not kind of invite your designer of choice to spend a week, 2 weeks with you and really give the project your attention? In particular, I was talking to a designer called John Vickers, who was saying he had spent a week in a chalet with his owner who wanted a really, really fast turnaround. And it meant that, you know, firstly, he could see how he lived. He could see this guy's taste, what he liked, what he didn't like. It's one thing kind of sharing pictures and mood boards and chatting, but it's quite another thing to walk around someone's home and get a sense of, okay, this is what they're, you know, this is what they like. So that helped. But it also meant in that space of the week, he went from kind of sketching out ideas by hand to having all the plans signed off for the new design within 3 weeks, because they were able to just spend that time together and get that done. So that sped things up a lot, and I thought it was quite interesting.
Yeah, what a surprise he's advocating that. Just a week in.
just a week in the chalet. A casual week in the chalet. Oh, it sounded quite intense, actually. I think, yeah, I think he spent a lot of time kind of chained to the drawing board. But there's no doubt that it makes things easier if you can just show things to someone, work through ideas in person rather than, you know, I think so often designers have a real challenge to face with owners being all over the world, not being able to deal with them directly. And just a week of kind of concentrated time can get that design stage off the ground much more quickly. Then there was a lot of talk about getting the right project lead. And this is where, if you've got a great captain, it pays off, because what the yard said was that they really like dealing with a super experienced captain. So someone who's done refits before, who can make budget decisions on behalf of the owner, who knows the yacht inside out. What was quite apparent was there aren't that many of them. So it might be that you've got a captain, but they're not quite up to the job. They're just someone who's better at sailing than they are project managing a refit, which is a different kettle of fish, really. And one of the things they cautioned against, which I thought was quite interesting, was that lots of owners then hire a kind of big management company, but actually you're kind of better off, was the general feeling anyway, going with a smaller management company that had a handful of really experienced senior staff than a big management company that would kind of, one of the interviewees used the phrase, chucking juniors and spreadsheets at you. But essentially there was this feeling that if you go for a big management company, they'll send you lots of updates and spreadsheets and stuff, but it won't actually help the project move any faster. It's just kind of more people to deal with. So that was interesting. Then they were talking about sort of just prepping the yacht as much as you can beforehand, you know, a year, 2 years even before you want to have the refit done, getting furniture made, getting parts ordered, getting everything teed up so that as soon as the yacht arrives, they can hit the ground running. Lots of the yards say very often owners kind of fight to get their yachts in the yard and then it sits there for a month, 2 months while they're working out the processes, what order things should be done in, waiting for things to arrive. If you can do all of that before, even some of the prep work, then as soon as the yard gets delivery of the yacht, they can work on it and get it turned around quickly. Then the next thing we were looking at was quick fixes. So if you do just want a bit of a kind of cosmetic facelift, largely for charter yachts, if you want something that looks and feels a bit more modern without taking it off the market for ages, some of the things you can do over the course of just a few months are things like wrapping the interior to kind of freshen that up. Cecile, our colleague in the US, mentioned, I think Galaxy had its interior wrapped, and she said it was really effective to see that firsthand. But you can do things like expand the swimming platform or replace the aft sliding door. These are kind of small things that aren't actually huge projects for a yard to embark on, and they're going to give you quite a lot of sort of bang for your buck in terms of making the boat feel very different, along with things like new carpets and things. In general, anything where you have to get into the interior of the boat, so where you're taking fixed things off walls or off floors and going behind pipework and things, that's going to really significantly add to your time. And lots of the yard said, you know, be wary of people that say they can do that in several months, because the reality is they're often just saying that and they know it's going to be a bit longer if you're, you know, you're going properly into the boat. And then the last couple of things that came up were just to try and be really flexible when it comes to the interiors. The supply chains are totally screwed right now, is the professional term, in terms of how long things are taking. So you want your interior designer to only present you with things they know are in stock, they know they can get really quickly. Don't look at anything else. And that means you're going to have to really adjust your expectations of, you know, what you can do, because you're not going to be able to, you know, dictate every single fabric sample, every single, you know, paint color. You're just going to have to go with what's available if you want things done quickly. And the last thing, which was a bit of a debate, was should you throw money at the problem? It's a kind of common solution when things aren't working out, especially if you've got the funds to do it. But the jury was sort of divided here. On the one hand, if you spend more money on shifts and you get people working weekends, people working evenings, you expand design teams, you expand CAD teams, you know, there's no doubt you can get things moving more and certainly more quickly. On the other hand, lots of the yards cautioned against things like, you know, there's this idea of double shifts. If you get a yard to work day and night to get your boat, does it mean you get it twice as quickly? Well, lots of them said no, because actually the time you spend sorting out the communication between the teams, the effect it has on morale and the people that are working on it, the complications that arise from having two separate groups of people working on the same project, by the time you've ironed all of that out, you know, it'll speed things up a bit, but certainly not twice as fast. The thing that was obvious to me is that if you are going to throw money at it, it probably makes sense to do that more at the design phase, like getting the design sorted quickly or getting things shipped in quickly, than the actual refit phase in the yard, because it seems like there's only so much you can speed up certain things and you can really affect the quality of what you're doing if you try and push the envelope too much.
I think this might have come out of the sort of refit feature that you did for the last refit special, but it really stuck with me because I remember a kind of similar calculation when I was doing very different, but my house was effectively a crack den and we did it up from scratch. But I remember with that always thinking there's three things. There's kind of speed, quality and price. And essentially you're only ever going to get two of those three. And I think that was a similar thing that came out. And it almost sounds like the same thing again. You can throw money at the situation. You might get a bit more speed, but you probably then aren't going to get the quality.
Yeah. And actually, one of the most interesting things to come out of it, which is, I think if I was an owner embarking on a refit and I wanted to do it quickly, is something I'd think about, is why not kind of split it into smaller chunks and split it around the world? So you do a bit of refit work in the Med, then you take the yacht across to the States, then you do a bit there. Maybe you do kind of, you do smaller stints. So, okay, the actual work you're having done is going to take longer and it might be slightly less efficient and less cost effective. But it helps you strike that balance of, well, I want to spend time on my boat. I don't want it locked away for 7 months or whatever. Well, this means you can, you know, only take it off the water at times when it suits you, at times when you wouldn't be able to use the boat yourself or whatever. So I think more yards are looking to do that, to kind of establish networks or to make things work in a way that owners can sort of chop and change the schedule a bit to work with what they want to do.
Wow, interesting. I look forward to reading that. That's November issue, right?
Yeah, November refit special. So coming out just after Monaco.
Amazing. So despite me disappearing off to Cannes last minute last week, there was still a podcast, thanks to you, Charlotte. No thanks to me. Because your interview ran with Stephen Roberts, who is the owner of Only Now. For anyone that's missed it, what can you tell us about the interview?
Well, he's quite an interesting one, and not only because he did a very fast refit, actually, but he's your typical pandemic owner, right? He had chartered boats before, really enjoyed it, and then the pandemic hit, and this someone, a broker, I think, texted him the details of Only Now, and he thought, you know what, I'm not going to be able to go on holiday in a hotel for at least a couple of years. Why don't I buy a boat and take matters into my own hands? And, you know, he talked about control. He wanted to be able to, you know, take matters in his own hands. The yacht was in Turkey at the time, and actually Turkey was on the green list if you were coming from the UK for a lot of that time. So he managed to spend a tremendous amount of time on board. And the thing that I also found quite interesting, he talks about, you know, he's a financial trader and he works on board. And he was saying, you know, he thinks he works better on the boat. He installed all new Wi-Fi and communications. He thinks being kind of away from the hubbub of the city and having this kind of isolation and sense of calm makes him better at his job, makes more rational decisions, better business decisions, which I thought was interesting because we know, you know, lots of owners have tried to work on their yachts and it seems to be that the majority of them agree. But what do you think, Spud? Do you think you could buckle down and get some serious work done on the super yacht?
Yeah, definitely. And boat needs to invest immediately. Yeah. Just for
quality of effort. Boat.
No, the boat, but I can see it though. I mean, to be fair, I mean, I'm actually working from home today because I need to get a feature written and I'm much better if I can just lock myself away, turn off my emails, turn off my Teams, not kind of constantly be asked questions. And I can see, you know, a super yacht is the ultimate way of kind of getting that seclusion and privacy, I suppose.
I interviewed Carl Pickering the other day of Lazzarini Pickering for an article about kind of home offices or kind of offices on board. And he said something which I think is really true, which is that over the past few years, we've totally adapted our view of home and work, you know, work-life balance, to the point where it used to be the case that if you were on the yacht on holiday and someone called you and interrupted you, you thought, oh my God, who's this idiot interrupting my holiday? Now you think, okay, my holiday isn't 2 weeks, it's 2 months, and I don't mind if I have to do a bit of work because I'm out here for a much longer stint. And okay, you know, I've got a meeting this afternoon, but I can, you know, I can have a swim just before. And he was talking about, you know, changes to the boardroom on the boat where you've got, you know, seats that can cope with people in swimming trunks and sun cream on hands, and it's become a much more flexible, you know, work isn't an annoying interruption if actually you're out there for 2 months, 6 months. It's part of your working life. And I think it's interesting to see that kind of more positive shift, that people are sort of embracing working on the boat a lot more rather than it being something they feel they have to do for a couple of hours at the beginning of the day. So speaking of work, we should look at what everyone else has been working on and take a look at the news. And if you think you'd work better on a super yacht, you might find this first item an interesting proposition to take a look at. This is the news that the Italian Sea Group has announced a new 50-metre super yacht concept called Panorama. The yacht features design from Treviso-based studio Pereda & Partners and is set to be built at the group's Carrara shipyard under the Admiral brand. Panorama will feature a steel hull, aluminium superstructure and has a gross tonnage of 499 GT. The design team is focused on creating a continuous connection between the interior and exterior by eliminating visual barriers, using high overheads where possible, and ensuring plenty of natural light can filter from the outside in. Accommodation is offered for 12 guests across 6 cabins, comprising 4 main deck suites and a lower VIP suite that can be converted into a TV room if necessary. And the owner's suite is found on the upper deck and enjoys an open view on three sides thanks to curved glass with access to a private bow deck. That sounds delightful.
Yeah, it looks great. There's lots of lovely renderings online, so we'll add the link with the podcast and make sure you go and have a look. Next up, we have the Australian shipyard Silver Yachts has announced the launch of its 85.3-metre Explorer project, Globalfast. It's the second hull in the shipyard's all-aluminium Silver World Explorer series and joins her sister ship, Bold, on the water. The two share a similar military-style exterior profile by designer Espen Nueno, with triangular windows and a band of tinted glazing amidships. Onboard highlights include a commercial helipad, hangar and refueling facilities, and a large aft deck with an 8-ton crane for the launch and recovery of toys and tenders. Project Globalfast is scheduled for delivery next month, but also under construction at Silver Yachts is the 79.5-metre Project Silver Edge, which is another Espen design and was started on spec earlier this year.
Sounds really interesting as well. Then we have the news that Turkish shipyard New Marine has unveiled a 30.7-metre model that will be fitted with hybrid electric propulsion. The model, named the 30XP, was unveiled during the Cannes Yachting Festival last week, where the yard also took the opportunity to announce that three units have been sold ahead of its launch in 2024. The unveiling coincides with the brand's 30th anniversary, and the new model bridges the gap between the 26XP and the 32XP. The 30XP offers a five-cabin layout that accommodates 10 guests. The master cabin is located on the main deck and benefits from full-height windows with an optional fold-down balcony. Elsewhere, the yacht offers plenty of scope for customisation, with options for an open-air dining area on the main deck aft and a covered sun deck. The motor yacht has a spacious beach club with generous headroom that is achieved by raising the deck above, which becomes a lounging area. Three fold-down balconies, meanwhile, promote a continuous connection to the water and create a complete space of 43 square metres. New Marine is doing some really interesting stuff right now. They're a name that just keeps coming up. We discussed them a while back when we were talking about smaller boats with metal hulls. And the 30XP brings the New Marine range up to five models, including a proposed 55XP flagship. So they're currently developing about 12 yachts per year, and they're looking to increase their production with a new facility that's due for completion in a few years' time. So it'll be interesting, definitely one to watch, I think, in terms of what happens when they get that extra space, given they seem to be selling these new models so well.
Yeah, I know Stuart obviously visited them when he did his grand tour of Turkey back in Q1. And he said, yeah, they can't seem to build the yachts fast enough. So this new facility will obviously help them achieve that. That's it for news, and we will move on to our traditional data section in a minute. But before we do that, I thought it might be interesting just to have a quick glance at August's brokerage figures. Again, the full article can be found on the boat business section of the website. The top line is that the brokerage market has seen a surge in the number of owners putting their yachts up for sale in August, bringing the total value of new listings across the month to €759.7 million. So that number represents a twofold increase on the July figures and is the highest month total in 2022 so far. It's probably not a huge surprise. It's probably likely spurred on by kind of end of the summer and the incoming European boat show season. So it's seen as a traditional time to put your yacht on the market. So there were 65 new arrivals on the sales market with several big ticket listings, including the 85.6-metre Abercorn Rasman B2, which is asking $88 million with Moravia Yachting, and the 72-metre Tankoa flagship Solo, which is asking $71 million with Evanston. So interestingly, sales months for the figure declined slightly, with just 21 recorded sales totaling €173.9 million. And the most significant sale closed in August was the 82.5-metre Secret, which has now been renamed Sea Pearl. And that was concluded by Burgess and Fraser with an asking price of $78
million. So a lot on the market then, and still some pretty high asking prices, it looks like.
Yeah, I think it's good in that there's been a lot of talk about lack of inventory, and it does seem like August has probably boosted that and that there is some real quality still to be found there. And you can see that by the kind of yachts attending list at Monaco Yacht Show. There's definitely going to be some interesting sales to be made.
Yeah, we'll have to keep an eye on what happens there. On to the data now, and speaking of big new arrivals, that's what we're going to be looking at this week. So this week's data, as ever, brought to you by our exclusive market intelligence platform, Boat Pro, is focusing on launch and delivery activity in the 60 metres plus category this year compared to the past couple of years. So let's take a look at the stats. So these are looking at 60 metre plus new launches from January to September. So if we look at deliveries, first of all, back in 2020, there were 16. 2021, there were 18. And this year, they've been 15. So a bit of a dip there. Then if we look at the total LOA, in 2020, it was 1,358. 2021, it was 1,457. And in 2022, it was 1,194. So a bit of a drop down again before 2020. The average LOA has gone down as well. In 2020, it was 84.9 metres. In 2021, it was 80.9 metres. This year, it's coming out at 79.6 metres. It's going down. We've launched the same number of motor yachts this year as we did in 2020. There were 18 of them in 2021. No sailing boats this year, no sailing boats last year, one sailing yacht in 2020 in the 60 metres plus category. Semi-custom boats, three of them this year, five of them last year, three of them in 2020, so kind of slight rise last year. And then the largest sort of boats in this category, in 2021, there was the 140-metre Scheherazade. Last year, there was the 142-metre Nord. And this year, there's obviously the huge 160-metre Blue. So running through all of this, it looks a bit like we're seeing a bit of decline here, both in the size and the length and the volume of boats. But, and it's a big but, there's obviously been a bit of a weird year here, and that's slightly throwing things off, I think. In fact, I had to laugh when I saw the document that our stats guru, Raphael, has prepared for this podcast, because he'd written very big and bold, numbers can be dangerous. And he's not wrong, numbers can be dangerous. These are not necessarily representative of what's going on here. As he pointed out, we've obviously had the impacts of the war in Ukraine. And we know, that the sanctions and things has complicated things. There are at least three main projects that are linked to that situation that haven't been delivered so far. If we did include them, we would reach the level of last year, which is obviously a very good year. And then there are also the sort of supply chain issues resulting as a part of that, as part of Brexit, the current energy issues as well, which are meaning that many projects are running late. If we counted pending deliveries, we would have more deliveries at the end of this year than in 2021. So we'll keep an eye on that and let you know. But it's obviously a strange time with lots of things slightly in limbo, but looking similar to last year, if not the same in terms of the stats.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where we're at by the end of the year. Hopefully then that will give a better understanding.
Well, that's it for this week. No more data, no more news, no more boat show catch-ups. But obviously, we're all off to Monaco soon, so we hope to see you all then.
Yeah, thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll be back to talk all things Monaco next week.